we can now obtain this incredibly dangerous chemicals that actually kill the unborn child just through the mail, through telemedicine.
Medical abortions. The battle continues in the courts, but what do the medical ethicists say? We go in depth with our expert panel. Mother Teresa, Junipero Serra, John Henry Newman, all proclaimed saints during the pontificate of Pope Francis. We celebrate the 10th anniversary of his papacy with a look at those he has canonized.
There's some people out there with really bitter and broken hearts, and they need conversion. Otherwise, we're just going to have more violence.
Catholic campus ministries step up to address the issues and help students traumatized after a series of shootings at universities across the country.
There's history, but there's also a presence that you can't put into words.
And we take you to a little house in Ohio where big things happened. The story of the servant of God who healed Mother Angelica. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Hello, and welcome to EWTN News In Depth. An important development this week as our nation continues to navigate the post-Roe world, pushing abortion regulations to the states. Last weekend, Wyoming became the first state in the country to explicitly outlaw abortion pills after the governor acted on two abortion-related bills. Medical abortions account for more than half of all abortions in America. Republican Governor Mark Gordon signed the abortion pill ban on March 17th, making it illegal to prescribe, dispense, distribute, sell, or use any drug for the purpose of performing an abortion. Violation of the law is punishable by a $9,000 fine or 6 months in jail. Pregnant women are exempt from being prosecuted. The law takes effect July 1st if there's no court intervention. The second bill, known as the Life is a Human Right Act, is a more sweeping piece of legislation that bans abortion under most circumstances. It does have exceptions, including rape, incest, or when the woman's life is in danger. That law, which took effect last Sunday, is now temporarily blocked after an abortion rights group immediately filed a challenge. All of this comes as a federal judge in Texas considers a case that could ban abortion pills nationwide. The Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine is one of the four pro-life medical groups challenging the Food and Drug Administration's approval of mifepristone. It's the first of two pills used in medical abortions.
The impact that this chemical abortion procedure has on a woman's body is generally it's the starving of the food needed through blocking progesterone for your unborn child. And then the second drug is what forcibly expels the baby from your uterus.
The safety of chemical abortions is at the heart of the lawsuit seeking to suspend the availability of abortion pills. The lawsuit alleges that the FDA ignored its own research and testing standards when approving the drug. Justice Department lawyers representing the FDA strongly deny the plaintiff's claim that the drug is unsafe and had not been properly vetted, saying it went through rigorous scientific testing before it was approved more than 20 years ago. Lawyers for the drug company which makes the abortion pill, Danco, also argued on behalf of the FDA in court. There's a lot happening with the Texas case and with the recent laws passed and challenged in Wyoming. Dr. Joseph Meany, president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and Heather Hacker, a former Texas Assistant Solicitor General, join me now to give us a better understanding of what these laws mean for the right to life in America. Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Meany, let's start with you. Can you explain the science behind the ethics of abortion pills? We're talking about ending a human life between conception and about 10 to 12 weeks. What's the framework for considering this issue?
So, I mean, the main framework, of course, is that abortion, direct abortion, is never acceptable from an ethical perspective, certainly from a Catholic natural law perspective. But, you know, this issue even goes further, and I think that what is being challenged in the court here is the basic ethical principle of informed consent. that one cannot provide drugs without providing proper safeguards and proper informed consent. And that is actually what is being challenged in the court case.
And when you're talking about proper informed consent, can you give me a little better understanding of what that means?
So essentially, as a medical principle, it is that patients need to know all the risks and possible benefits and side effects, and to have as many safeguards put into place so that their lives are not unduly put in danger. And what has been alleged here is that the FDA fast-tracked the approval and that they've taken away so many safeguards that now individuals who are taking these abortion pills are not getting proper informed consent or proper safeguards.
And proper care. We'll talk about that in a second. Heather, you've argued and followed this issue closely in courts around the country. Why is the Wyoming legislative ban on abortion pills important when more than a dozen states cover them in broad laws that prohibit all forms of abortion?
Well, the state of Wyoming actually had a trigger law that was supposed to ban abortion if Roe v. Wade were overturned, as it was in the Dobbs case last summer. But that law has been enjoined. So as of right now, abortion is legal in Wyoming. And so this was an effort by the legislature to restrict abortion, notwithstanding that trigger ban being enjoined.
And what is the future of this? Is this something that's held up in courts right now?
So yes, just a couple days ago, a Wyoming state court judge entered a temporary restraining order against the law. Now, the law had not gone into effect yet. It was effective, as you mentioned, in July of this year. And so there's still some time left before the law would go into effect for that legal wrangling. So the next step in the process would be for that same state court judge to have a hearing on a preliminary injunction motion. But as of right now, there is an order preventing that law from being effective.
And so they'll have to fight it out in the courts. Dr. Meany, back to you. When can we find background for this issue in church teaching? Where can we find that? What forms our understanding of human life that makes this protection so important?
Yeah, I think St. John Paul II said it the best in his wonderful encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae, where he basically talked about a culture of life and a culture of death and the incredible dignity of the human person, and we can never directly kill an innocent human being. And I think what's very important to see whenever the issue of abortion comes up is that there are loving solutions that do not involve killing. And there is really a terrible misunderstanding, I think, of the ethics and the dignity of the human person that think that we can sacrifice some individuals in order to help others. So I think that's the key point. And of course, going back, you know, to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith has a wonderful declaration on procured abortion. But I mean, the church's teaching really goes back to the very first centuries, which is a beautiful thing to see all this continuity about standing up for life and the importance of human life.
Absolutely. Now, Heather, did the Supreme Court address this issue at all in its ruling in the Dobbs case when it overturned the right to abortion created by Roe and Casey? Is this a medical abortion issue something that comes up there?
No. It was mainly focused on whether or not the U.S. Constitution protects a right to abortion. And the answer to that question was no. So that necessarily means that states can regulate abortion as they see fit. The court only said that any state law that regulates abortion would be subject to rational basis review, which is the lowest standard of review and is very deferential to the state typically. So what that means is that states are now free to regulate abortion as they want. And so Wyoming did that, but now the question shifts to state courts to determine if it, under state law or the state constitution, whether restrictions on abortion comport with those legal requirements. So it's shifted from federal court to state court now.
Right. And so then what's the standard? Before, under Casey, we had a 22-week standard or a viability standard. How has that changed? And how are courts at the state level supposed to apply the difference between these moments of the pregnancy?
So the standard now is basically whatever passes rational basis review. The state can prohibit abortion, all abortion. Some states do, and other states allow abortion up to 40 weeks. So that's all up to the states now, and the federal courts, at least the Supreme Court determined that the federal constitution does not speak to that.
That's great. Dr. Meany, before I go to Heather on the legal implications of this, why is it critical that these laws not be used to persecute women?
Yeah, I think it's so important to see that in many, many cases, abortion is actually something that is being forced on the mother, that she doesn't want to go through with the abortion, but there's a huge amount of pressure being brought upon her. And so it's very important, I think, to realize that she can often be a victim as well, and that the law should be really going after the perpetrators, those who are profiting from the abortions, those who are pushing the abortions, rather than those who are the victims of abortion.
Heather, the criminal implications and the penalties from the Wyoming law are serious. Are these different from the $10,000 fines the initial Texas laws imposed last year?
So if you're mentioning the Texas heartbeat law, those would be different. The Texas heartbeat law imposed civil penalties rather than criminal penalties, but Texas does prohibit abortion now, and it is a criminal prohibition. And several other states also do that as well. So at least in Texas, we still have the heartbeat law, which imposes civil penalties, and then we also have a criminal prohibition on abortion. And those laws both have exceptions.
So we're looking at exceptions, but at the same time, criminal penalties for the involvement in abortion. Heather, what can we expect as legislatures pass new laws and courts across the country are embroiled in more legal action? Will action from Congress or the Supreme Court make a difference, or are we just going to have to battle this out state by state?
So I think it will be a battle state by state. As I mentioned, the main battleground for these questions as to whether states can restrict or regulate abortion and how far they can go. The forum for that has now shifted mainly to state courts. And so there are states that are considering now, the state Supreme Courts are considering whether or not a state, the state constitution protects a right to abortion. Now, you know, it's an interesting question because many states that had previously found a state right to abortion based that reasoning in significant part on the reasoning that the Supreme Court had applied in Roe and Casey in finding a right to abortion under the federal constitution. So some of those states, if there are challenges in those states, the court will have to sort of go back to the drawing board in terms of locating where in the state constitution there is such a right to abortion. And so there are state courts that are looking at that question right now.
Well, we'll be looking at the state courts, the legislatures, and of course, with our eyes on 2024. Thank you so much, Heather. Dr. Meany, stay with us. We've got one more issue that we want to discuss with you. Another pressing issue is the effort in at least one state to ban the use of the abortion reversal protocol, which can stop a chemical abortion by providing progesterone supplements. Legislators in Colorado have introduced such a bill banning the reversal. We'll have a comprehensive report on that in the coming weeks on a future edition of EWTN News In Depth. And yet another ethically challenging medical issue doctors are facing, transgender care. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Doctrine just issued guidance for Catholic physicians and hospitals to consider. The bishops say doctors must employ all appropriate resources to mitigate the suffering of those who struggle with gender incongruence, and that Catholic healthcare services must not perform interventions that aim to transform the sexual characteristics of a human body, because those procedures do not respect the fundamental order of the human person as an intrinsic unity of body and soul with a body that is sexually differentiated. They emphasize that medical providers should always give the best medical care and compassionate accompaniment, no matter what the patient is suffering from. Legislation on what has been named gender-affirming care nationwide varies state to state. Many states have placed limits on gender transition surgeries and hormone therapies, particularly focused on protecting youth. This year, Utah, Mississippi, South Dakota, and Tennessee enacted laws banning most or all gender transition surgeries and hormone therapies for minors. And just this week, governors in Georgia and Iowa signed similar bills. Joining us again now to discuss this growing ethical dilemma in the medical field is Dr. Joseph Meany. What impact does a letter like this one from the USCCB have on Catholic doctors and hospitals?
So it's very important because it basically reaffirms Catholic teaching, but it goes specifically to the issue of Catholic healthcare and Catholic healthcare professionals and what they can and cannot do based on Catholic teaching. I think it's very, very important guidance.
Now, Dr. Meany, why was this necessary? Are there challenges in hospitals and for doctors who are Catholic hospitals, doctors that are living with their faith that merited this document? Isn't this intrinsic connection between the body and the soul something the church has always taught?
That's correct, yes. And actually, I think we're in a period of incredible cultural confusion, but also a huge amount of pressure, also from the government and from other different institutions. And so there's a real need to have a strong religious liberty objection to be involved in any of these kinds of transgender interventions. And this doctrinal note really provides, black and white, this is what the Catholic Church stands for, and really helps Catholic institutions and individuals to point to that as part of their religious objection to doing that.
Now, is it normal for some of these entities, both medical schools that are Catholic and hospitals, to have training associated with letters like this from the USCCB?
Yes. So, basically, the ethical and religious directives for Catholic healthcare services provided by the U.S. bishops give a whole series of guidelines on what is and what is not Catholic healthcare. The problem is that it hasn't really spoken to the transgender issue yet specifically. And so this doctrinal note kind of fills in a little void there that some people were saying that there is not really, authoritative black and white guidance, but now there is.
So let's talk about the mental health issue very quickly. Ted Lasso's team was just on Capitol Hill last week talking about mental health. And this document from the USCCB stresses a pastoral approach that is cognizant of reinforcing church teaching. Was this necessary to accompany those who have already undergone surgical transition procedures?
Yes. So there are so many individuals now who are detransitioning, who see that they were mistaken in trying to transform their appearance from one sex to the other. And there's a real need, I think, to prevent particularly young people, and the document goes into that, from being kind of railroaded into irreversible changes in their bodies through puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and even surgeries.
That pastoral, just really quickly, that pastoral initiative, what does that look like from a doctor's perspective? Is it affirming care? Is it affirming the way that they're feeling?
No. So essentially what has to be affirmed is the person's biological sex and the fact that, male and female, God created us, and we have to accept who we are rather than try to change it. I think Pope Francis said it very well when he said, there's a real temptation today to go against God, the creator, and to reject how we were created, to recreate ourselves. But there's a certain humility in saying, look, I was made, I was created male or female, and I should develop in that way. So there's no possibility that I have a soul in the wrong body, et cetera. Those are very ancient sort of mistaken opinions.
Well, we're grateful for the clarity on this from you and from the bishops. Thank you so much, Dr. Meany.
Thank you.
And there's much more ahead on this week's edition of EWTN News In Depth. Next, the Pope and his saints. In this 10th anniversary month of his papacy, we take a look at the many revered figures Pope Francis has elevated to sainthood. Stay right there. We'll be back in a moment. All Christians are called to be saints, to live virtuous lives offered for God. The official army of saints has grown with some truly beloved figures during Pope Francis's papacy. As we commemorate his 10th anniversary as Pope, Rudolf Gehring tells us about Francis's saints.
Since Pope Francis was elected Pope 10 years ago, he has canonized several people almost every year. Men and women, old and young, people from different eras and social backgrounds. What most of them have in common, however, they all stood up for the poor, for those on the margins of society. This is fitting for a pontiff who sees himself as a pope for the periphery. On May 12, 2013, Pope Francis carried out his first canonization. In addition to two Latin American religious sisters, Laura Montoya and Maria Guadalupe Garcia Zavala, the Holy Father also canonized Antonio Primalto and his 800 companions who were murdered in the Ottoman invasion of the Italian city of Otranto in 1480. Since then, about 100 other saints have been added. In 2014, Francis canonized two of his predecessors. One was John the 23rd, who was elected Pope in 1958. During his 4.5-year pontificate, he convened the Second Vatican Council. In the presence of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, Pope Francis also canonized John Paul II, who led the Church into the new millennium. During his visit to the US in 2015, Francis canonized Junipero Serra Ferra in Washington, D.C. The Spanish Franciscan priest came to what is now California in 1749, founded mission stations, and spread the gospel in America.
San Tommaso diceva che il credibile è Gesù.
St. Thomas said that the credible person embodies Jesus. Because a credible person does what he says, and actions speak louder than words. A true witness is the one who speaks with his actions, without great announcements.
One woman whose deeds speak for themselves is Mother Teresa. The nun dedicated her life to the poorest of the poor in the slums of Calcutta. The Order of Missionaries of Charity, founded by her, continues Mother Teresa's work. As Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero demanded social justice and opposed the military dictatorship of the time. Romero was shot by a death squad in 1980 while preaching in church. Pope Francis canonized him in 2018. 1 year later, the Holy Father canonized John Henry Newman. Newman was a member of the Anglican Church of England. He converted to the Catholic Church despite much hostility. He died in 1890 and continues to influence generations of theologians today. Charles de Foucault also has a great impact up to the present day. He was shot dead in the Sahara on December 1, 1916 by Bedouin marauders. Charles de Foucault, who had never founded a monastery himself, served as an inspiration to other founders of religious orders. He was canonized by Pope Francis in 2022. It is possible that Pope Francis will soon canonize a teenager as well. Carlo Acutis died of leukemia at the age of 15. A devout Catholic, he used the internet by the early 2000s. At the age of 11, he created a website with an online directory of Eucharistic miracles. Perhaps in the future, the Church will also see the Holy Father canonize an entire family. On September 10, 2023, Cardinal Semeraro will beatify the Ulmer family on behalf of Pope Francis. The family had hidden 8 Jews during World War II, but were betrayed. The Nazis then killed not only the Jews, but also the Ulmer family, including a still unborn child.
The Church, with this decision, shakes our consciences, reminding us of the sacredness of every human life that begins at the moment of conception and up to natural death. So, it's a great reconfirmation. It's a great hymn to the holiness and the dignity of every human life.
Whether man or woman, young or old, fearless martyr or silent servant of the Lord, Pope Francis reminds the Church that every person has the same vocation, the vocation to holiness. In Rome, Rudolf Gehrig, EWTN News in Depth.
And we aren't done with the topic of potential sainthood. Still to come, we go to the Miracle House in Ohio to learn about a servant of God who impacted the life of our very own Mother Angelica.
It is an environment in which an individual's journey to sainthood began and was observed by many people.
The Ohio woman who healed the sick, the Rhoda Wise story coming up. But first, top headlines in the Week in Review. The U.S. reacts to this week's meeting between leaders of China and Russia as the war in Ukraine rages on. And the Vatican's take on the continuing bloodshed in Ukraine. The Holy See's foreign minister is on the record when we return.
News about Russian President Vladimir Putin tops the week in review. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Putin for the war crime of unlawful deportation of children from Ukraine to Russia. As we covered on EWTN News in Depth in February, Yale's Humanitarian Research Lab reported thousands of Ukrainian children have been relocated to so-called re-education camps in Russia. At these camps, children are often held for months with no way of contacting their families in Ukraine. Both Putin and Maria Lvova-Belova, Russian Commissioner for Children's Rights, have helped facilitate the widespread deportations. The International Criminal Court found that it calls reasonable grounds that Putin and Lvova-Belova are responsible for.
For the alleged war crimes of deportation of children from Ukrainian-occupied territories into the Russian Federation. It is forbidden by international law for occupying powers to transfer civilians from the territory they live in to other territories. Children enjoy special protection under the Geneva Convention.
The Russian president likely won't be arrested anytime soon. He'd have to step foot in one of the court member nations to be apprehended. But experts believe the warrant greatly limits the Kremlin's international reach and is a major step in holding Russia accountable for the crimes it has committed in the war. Chinese President Xi Jinping, one of Putin's strongest and few remaining allies, made a visit to the Kremlin this week. The Kremlin welcomed Xi Jinping with pomp and circumstance as he and Putin embraced each other as old friends. China's visit sends a strong message to Western nations attempting to isolate Russia over its involvement in Ukraine. During their closely watched meeting, the two leaders signed an agreement to expand natural gas trade and other economic ties. The two also discussed potential peace talks for the war in Ukraine, which Kyiv said it will never agree to without a full return of all its territory. The U.S. has repeatedly condemned China and Russia's proposals for peace. White House spokesman John Kirby said China is too aligned with Russian propaganda to play a constructive role in the war.
I don't think you can reasonably look at China as impartial in any way. They haven't condemned this this invasion. They haven't stopped buying Russian oil and Russian energy. President Xi saw fit to fly all the way to Moscow, hasn't talked once to President Zelensky, hasn't visited Ukraine, hasn't bothered to avail himself of the Ukrainian objective, and he and his regime keeps parroting the Russian propaganda that this is somehow a war of the West on Russia, that it's some sort of existential threat to Mr. Putin. That's just a bunch of malarkey. Ukraine posed no threat to anybody, let alone Russia.
Kirby argues that encouraging a ceasefire now would legitimize the gains Russia made during the invasion. And he pointed out the China-Russia talks this week did not yield any true breakthroughs to resolve the conflict and did not acknowledge the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine. Meanwhile, a show of support in Ukraine from Japan. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida to Kyiv for a surprise visit. Dual visits from China and Japan underscore deep tensions between the two Asian countries as they assert their support for their allies on opposite ends of the war. Kishida will chair the Group of Seven summit in May, where Western allies will discuss continued support to Ukraine. He is the first Japanese prime minister to visit a war zone since World War II. The war in Ukraine has been a top concern for diplomats of the Holy See. The Vatican has a robust diplomatic presence around the world, representing Pope Francis and the priorities of the Catholic Church. Reporter Colin Flynn recently spoke with the Vatican's foreign minister. Here's Archbishop Paul Gallagher on the record.
The Vatican, as well as being the spiritual guide for more than a billion Catholics around the world, is also an internationally recognized independent state, Vatican City State. Also, just like any other country, it has government departments called dicasteries, and ministers and diplomats.
Archbishop Gallagher of the Holy See.
Archbishop Paul Gallagher is one of the Vatican's top diplomats.
Good to see you again, Prime Minister.
His title is Secretary of Relations with States, or in other words, the Vatican's foreign minister. As part of his role, he is the one who often takes high-level meetings with heads of state when they come to the Vatican after they have met with Pope Francis. EWTN News sat down with Archbishop Gallagher at the Apostolic Palace in the Vatican. When we look around the world, in your opinion, what would be the three biggest challenges, diplomatically speaking?
Well, obviously, the biggest diplomatic challenge at the moment for the world and for the international community is the war in Ukraine. After that, I think then we have the climate change. After that, I think a lot of the things are the just general conflictuality that we have in the Middle East, parts of Africa, also destabilization of Latin America.
The war in Ukraine is something that the Vatican has been outspoken on from as soon as it started in 2022. Archbishop Gallagher traveled to the war-torn country where, on behalf of the Pope, he appealed for peace. Now that nations across the world are sending tanks and other military equipment, the Vatican, of course, has no military might around the world, but through diplomacy, what can the Vatican help with or help to try and achieve there?
Well, we can try to keep what I call the dream of peace alive. We can talk about dialogue and peace, which in many areas are words which are not appreciated at the moment. And we can understand that. We understand the suffering of the Ukrainian people, and they're not thinking in terms of dialoguing with Russia at the moment. But what we also can do is maintain to some degree contacts with the Russian authorities through the embassies, through the nuncio in Moscow.
You mentioned there beautifully the dream of peace. You try and keep that alive. And do you find, like when Pope Francis famously went down to the Russian ambassador here and broke protocol, when you were dealing with Russia, are they open to dialogue or is it falling on deaf ears?
Certainly there's openness there and the messages going backwards and forwards. Not very many messages, but some. I think that much of the commitment of arms by the West and by NATO, the United States and others, inevitably is going to be perceived by Russia as an escalation of the conflict, to which they will presumably make an appropriate response. So I think we've got to be prepared for the long haul.
One of the most controversial Vatican diplomatic deals has been the provisional agreement between the Vatican and the Communist People's Republic of China, known more commonly as the Vatican-China deal. The Vatican has been criticized for allowing the Chinese state to play a role in the selection of bishops in the Catholic Church there. The Vatican says that while this arrangement is not ideal, it was the next best thing. When the Vatican and diplomats like yourself representing the Holy See are going to broker a deal like this with China, what tips the balance in terms of whether you agree to or not agree to make a deal like this?
Yes, obviously the objective is to get the best deal possible, which certainly this agreement is not the best deal possible because of the other party. They were only prepared to go so far and to agree to certain things. But this was what was possible at the time. It was always going to be difficult. It was always going to be used by the Chinese party to bring greater pressure on the Catholic community, particularly on the so-called underground church. So we just go forward. There have been some bishops appointed. There are negotiations underway for the appointment of other bishops. It's going to be difficult. China, everything is done in, obviously, in the context of Chinese domestic politics and Chinese, particularly domestic politics. And therefore, we can only achieve so much, and we can only achieve it quite slowly. But as one of the things that the Chinese and the Catholic Church and the Holy See have in common is that we don't think in months or even in years. We're thinking in terms of a much longer time.
The role of top Vatican diplomat is not only a symbolic one that shows unity and solidarity between the Vatican and countries across the globe, but it is also an opportunity for the Church to express its views on social and human issues that it feels strongly about, like climate change, immigration, and abortion.
It must be incredibly challenging for you and for the Holy See when you're dealing with various heads of state who come here to the Vatican to visit, or your counterparts in various governments, and when their policies can sometimes be so at odds with the teachings of the Catholic Church.
Well, obviously you talk about some things and you don't talk about others.
Is that the answer, just to kind of leave out the elephant in the room?
No. It's not. We're not like that. We do try to raise issues, to show our concern, and to remind people of their responsibilities. We also, I think, try to, shall we say, challenge some of the assumptions about some of these policies. That, for example, that some people say, well, okay, we understand that is coming from a religious point of view. And many people in Europe, for example, would say, well, you know, religion is a rather private, marginal question. Well, we'd argue that no. Religion in the world is something that is important to a little bit over 80% of the people on this planet, and that these their religious beliefs have an enormous effect upon them. So we try to maybe change the context in which some of these decisions are being made, and also that if people are wanting to put things, that there has to be respect for conscience, and this there is in many places we see an erosion of conscience, and we will continue to present the position of the Church to those who are willing to listen.
Archbishop Paul Gallagher, it's been lovely talking to you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. God bless.
Vatican City State and the Catholic Church have huge influence internationally, and with the war in Ukraine showing no signs of abating, as well as other human rights injustices around the world, the role of the Church's diplomats will continue to be key for the Catholic Church. In Rome, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
And this optimistic note, Finland has been named the happiest country in the world for the sixth year in a row. Each year, the World Happiness Report evaluates more than 150 countries and ranks them on factors like generosity, health, and freedom. Finland's closest neighbors, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, and Norway, also received high marks. The study found that benevolence surged across the globe as a result of the pandemic. The United States made the list at number 15. Curious to know Finland's secrets to happiness? The Nordic nation is offering a free masterclass to help visitors find their inner Finn. That's the Week in Review. We'll be right back.
What does it mean to mourn with people who are mourning? How do we do that well, and how do we walk with people that are really struggling?
Next, Young Catholics in Crisis. A series of university shootings shows the importance and strength of campus ministries. And religion in America. What a new report says about who is and who's not actively worshiping. Survey results when we come back.
On this program, we've discussed the efforts Catholic churches make to bring the faithful back to the pews, from outreach at the Super Bowl to bringing a friend back to Mass after the pandemic. Parishes around the country are trying to connect Americans, young and old, with their faith again. Those efforts won't be over anytime soon. New research suggests religion in America continues on a downward slope. A new survey from the Public Religion Research and Education Organization takes a look at the landscape of religion in America. In 2022, 23% of respondents identified as Catholic, compared to 44% who identified as Protestant and 6% who belonged to a different religion. Almost a third of respondents said they were religiously unaffiliated. The difference in generations is staggering, with almost 4 in 10 young Americans identifying as religiously unaffiliated, compared to only 20% of Americans over the age of 50. And more young adults are unaffiliated now than they were in the past. In 2006, only 23% of Americans aged 18 to 29 did not identify with a specific religion. Now, that number is almost double at 40%. While many in Generation Z are deserting formal religion, some young adults cling to their faith and, in the face of crisis, seek answers and healing from their church. During some recent mass shootings at universities across the country, Catholic ministers have stepped up to help students cope with fear and loss. Rizal Regis reports.
I think our initial reaction for myself and probably a number of us in the community was hoping it was a hoax.
Father Gordon Regal and students from Michigan State University recount the harrowing details the night a gunman opened fire on campus grounds.
I could see a stream of emergency vehicles going by and I was alone.
It was 8:18 p.m. on Monday, February 13, when the first shots rang out. Via mass texts and emails, they were informed of a shooting on campus and were instructed to shelter in place. As pastor of St. John Church and Student Center at MSU, Father Gordon, along with other priests and staff, ensured that the students who sought refuge at the center during the campus-wide lockdown were cared for.
Students in dorms, students in classrooms, students in laboratories, and yes, a small group of students locked down at the student center. It was beautiful how they cared for each other.
Hours go by, and they were still unaware of what was happening outside their doors.
It was a little effort into the early hours of the night just to make sure everybody had a place. And then, of course, to, more sadly, identify what students were injured, what students were where, and then to identify the parents that went with those students.
A little after midnight, the all clear was given. The next day, news broke out that three students were killed and another five were wounded from the shooting.
Brothers and sisters, it's a heavy night, obviously. My deepest hope for every single person in this room is not to take away the pain or the suffering. I can't do that. I can't make this better. But I deeply, deeply hope that in this Mass, you encounter the Father's love for you.
The following night, students gathered for the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass at St. John's, where Father Peter Ludwig offered words of consolation, prayers of hope, and repose of the souls of those who passed away.
The first time walking in today, it was just like a wave of relief knowing that there were other people here who had been through this, who had experienced this, that were here to just talk and just like people really just pouring themselves out to like make sure that we were like taken care of and heard. So that's meant a lot to me.
St. John Church and Student Center remained open, offering a safe haven for students.
We all got a text this morning saying that there would be adoration starting at 10 a.m. And so everybody, so people started coming here just to be with the Lord and say this is, this has happened, but Lord, we give this up to you to build something good out of the horrors of what happened.
The center continues to work tirelessly to bring spiritual and emotional support to the students, despite what Father Gordon described as a dark cloud hanging over the community.
I think there's going to be a lot of quiet wounds that students are going to carry with them, heavy heart, maybe a little bit of a fear, anxiety, things like that, that are going to be diagnosed through the time to come. These are those opportunities where we realize that life is a gift, and if we live it intentionally, beautiful things will happen if we live our faith.
What happened at MSU is just one of the tragedies that has devastated an entire university community in the recent months. In the early hours of November 13, 2022, on a Sunday morning, four University of Idaho students were stabbed and killed in their off-campus residence.
When the murders first took place, there was so much unknown. The first impact that we felt was obviously, profound sadness, confusion, wonderment.
The morning after, kind of the fear of, why did this happen? What's happening on campus? Are we going to be sent home?
They described the university and its surrounding community as being on edge the following day, with so many unknowns and no suspect in custody.
So the immediate reaction with St. Augustine's was we were supportive of the university. We were supportive of the police. We were supportive of the kids and the suffering. And then we had to wait like everybody else for answers.
As more details unfold about the four victims and what took place, Meyer said the little town of Moscow, Idaho, has never been the same. Despite it all, St. Augustine's continued to stay open, offering some sense of normalcy and serving as a beacon of light to the community. Copel was surprised to see that so many students still show up at the center. She believes it's the sense of security being in the presence of Christ.
Just having the opportunity to be here has been huge for the students, because they do need a place on campus that it's just, they know it's going to be open. They know there's always going to be people there.
However, Meyer believes the university can and will bounce back from this tragedy.
University of Idaho will return, will be stronger, and the St. Augustine's Catholic Center is joyfully, authentically Catholic. Churches where the youth are full, and it's beautiful. So we'll be all right.
But we can surrender this to God, and we can not live in fear of what might happen, and just trust this, like, we're in God's care.
Rasal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Prayers for these campus ministries that do so much to support their students.
She had a profound understanding of what suffering meant and in the Christian life.
The Catholic mystic and healer, whose life of ill health and struggle reflected those who flocked to her for a blessing. The life and times of Rhoda Wise when we return.
It's almost 7 years to the day that EWTN foundress Mother Angelica went to our Lord on Easter Sunday at the age of 92. Her life was a gift to all of you who watch this network and all of us who continue her mission. But her long life and her religious calling might not have happened if not for an Ohio woman named Rhoda Wise. EWTN News In Depth traveled to Canton to bring you her story. Here's reporter Mark Irons.
Enter this small, modest home in Canton, Ohio, where people have come out of plain curiosity or faith, or because they're in desperate need.
My husband is going to die, and there's nothing I can do about it.
In 2017, Betsy Shoag's husband, Mark, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. He was given 6 months to live. Heavy chemotherapy treatment left him weak, unable to complete basic tasks like eating, walking, or showering on his own. His wife saw the life being drained out of him.
Being a believer, being a devout Catholic, I knew that God would never abandon me. And so I turned to God.
A friend suggested she come to that house in Canton, where a woman had lived in the 1930s and 40s. Her name was Rhoda Wise.
She had a very soft voice, but I know she was also the disciplinarian of the family.
Canton native Karen Sigler learned all about the life of Rhoda Wise from Rhoda's daughter, Anna May, and wrote down the details in a book called Her Name Means Rose, The Rhoda Wise Story.
She loved our Lord dearly.
She lived through the Great Depression. Back then, the family home was just a three-room shack down the street from the city dump, but it was home for Rhoda.
I think she was serious, although we do have pictures of her where it looks like she could be pretty fun and silly at times, too.
The smile in this photograph may hide it, but Rhoda suffered. Her husband, George Wise, was an alcoholic who couldn't keep a job, and Rhoda was constantly in poor health. She faced serious complications after surgery to remove a 39-pound ovarian cyst. Separately, a bad leg injury left her foot deformed. But a source of joy came during a hospital stay when Catholic nuns began to teach Rhoda about the Virgin Mary, the Rosary, and the life of St. Therese, the little flower.
She and St. Therese were fast friends. And that devotion and the Rosary led her to ask to come into the church.
Rhoda, a lifelong Protestant, converted to Catholicism when she was 51 years old. Her health complications continued. Quotes from many of Rhoda's journal entries are included in Sigler's book, including this one of desperation. St. Therese, my little flower, and Jesus, won't you take pity and do something to help me? Rhoda had stomach cancer and an open abdominal wound which caused excruciating pain. But her doctor said nothing more could be done, so she was sent home with bad news.
She was in that room in her bed, expecting to die.
But after days of agony, there was an unforgettable experience, Rhoda recounted in her journal, May 1939. I was wide awake and saw Jesus sitting right by my bed.
She woke up on the in the early morning of May 28th to a light in that room, and when she turned to see what it was, Jesus was sitting in that chair by her bed. And she, you know, wasn't surprised to see him. She said, "Have you come for me?" And he said, "No, your time hasn't come yet."
A month later, another visit on June 28th, she wrote, "What happened to me was done by no dream. I saw Jesus again last night. St. Therese, the little flower, was right by him. She put her hand on my stomach and said, 'You have been tried in the fire and not found wanting. Faith cures all things.' I looked at my stomach. I was entirely healed." What Rhoda experienced took place in this room. It was her bedroom at the time, and the chair Jesus sat on remains. When Betsy Shoag visited in her desperation, her husband Mark was too weak to come along. So she took one of his shirts with her.
I put Mark's literally, disgusting sweaty shirt on the chair that Jesus sat in, and I kneeled and I prayed. I think I actually prayed in Our Father.
And she prayed to Rhoda on Mark's behalf, asking for a miracle to save his life. For decades, others just like Betsy have come here. Rhoda's granddaughter, Darlene Zestani, is a witness.
All the people, all around our yard.
Darlene grew up in this house.
It was home. My bed was there. And at the time, there was a window over here.
She was born on her grandmother's birthday. As a girl, she remembers the strangers who would come over.
I never knew when I come home who was going to be here.
Rhoda's story began to spread through word of mouth, and people would write or visit. After her first miraculous healing, she reported another visit from St. Therese, and this time her foot was healed. The cast she walked out of is still on display. By the early 1940s, thousands were coming to seek physical healings or spiritual help. Rhoda would not turn them away, including a teenage girl named Rita Rizzo. She had an unbearable stomach condition, but was healed after Rhoda told her to pray a novena to St. Therese. It would inspire Rita to give her own life to Christ as a nun, and she became known as Mother Angelica, the foundress of EWTN. Rhoda had plenty of believers, and there were also skeptics.
She was mocked, you know, she was not taken seriously.
But her story is documented with photographs. Really, starting on Good Friday in 1942, she began to openly bleed, showing signs of the stigmata, the wounds of Christ's crucifixion. Her love for Jesus grew, and she continued offering up her own life as a sacrifice.
To suffer again so that other people could get the kinds of graces that she had gotten. And, oh my goodness, do people get graces here? It astounds me.
Within 2 weeks of coming down here, it all changed.
Following her visit to the home of Rhoda Wise in 2018, Betsy says her husband Mark recovered his strength, his quality of life, his cancer has stabilized, and more than 5 years later, he's alive.
This was somebody who literally was just given only 6 months to live. The doctors have said, I don't know what to say. I can't explain what has happened. Something has happened. I don't know what it is, but something significant has happened. And those are some pretty powerful words.
Karen Sigler has heard many similar stories.
And it's impossible not to affect you. You know, like all these people aren't making this up. There's too many of them.
Throughout the rest of her life, Rhoda would recount multiple visits from Jesus and St. Therese, including regular visits on the anniversary of her first healing, when large crowds would gather outside the home. Rhoda's window was photographed prior to the heavenly visits, and when they were believed to be happening, a powerful bright light can be seen shining out.
I've talked to people that were out there, and it's funny that they all didn't describe it the same. Some would tell me it was golden. Someone would tell me it was multicolored, but they all saw it.
Visitors today may see many amazing things inside this small home in Canton, Ohio. On display, there seems to be evidence to support the mystical. A rose petal imprinted with the image of St. Therese and bloodstained cloths from Rhoda's stigmata. But you won't find evidence of one profound miracle Rhoda received. Her husband, George, stopped drinking.
That's what she used to tell people was the greatest miracle our Lord worked for her. Oh, look at these.
Karen Sigler talks about Rhoda Wise as if she's an old friend, and she cares for Rhoda's home as if it's her own, in part because it is. In 1948, the crowd said goodbye.
When Rhoda died, a local paper reported around 14,000 people visited the funeral home. And in the procession that followed to the gravesite afterward, police said it was one of the largest processions in Canton history. And in the years that would follow, even more visitors would come to the home of Rhoda Wise.
Rhoda's daughter, Anna Mae, kept the home open to visitors for decades. And toward the end of her own life, she asked Karen to come live in the house and care for the place. She's been here 40 years.
Rhoda Wise's home. This is Karen.
She sees it as a calling from God.
Oh, there's a man coming.
Sigler still remembers what she thought when she first found out about the holy occupant of this home.
I couldn't believe we had a stigmatist in Canton, and nobody seemed to care.
For a story so incredible, it's almost a mystery how it has remained somewhat hidden, even to those who pass by all the time. Less than a mile from this house, Canton locals stop for coffee and comfort food at the Sunrise Cafe. The name Rhoda Wise and her picture aren't well known.
Not familiar with Rhoda Wise.
Have you ever seen her before? Or?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
But waiter John Spriandi says people from all over, most recently Texas, have stopped in on their way.
And they were asking me all about it. And I told him, I said, I'm sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Her home is known as a place of miracles, and Rhoda Wise is known as a servant of God in the Catholic Church. She may one day be recognized as a saint, someone who gave all to Christ.
Never be afraid to ask God for help. Never. And He is the ultimate healer.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
The Rhoda Wise story, so influential in Mother Angelica's own life. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.